This episode is brought to you by Thorne, and I have some incredible news for any of you that are in the military, first responder, or medical professions. In an effort to give back, Thorne is now offering you an ongoing 25% off each and every one of your purchases of their incredible nutritional solutions. Now, Thorne is the official supplement of CrossFit, the UFC, the Mayo Clinic, the Human Performance Project, and multiple special operations organizations. I myself have used them for several years, and that is why I brought them on as a sponsor. Some of my favorite products they have are their Multivitamin Elite, their Whey Protein, the Super EPA, and then most recently, Cinequil. As a firefighter, a stuntman, and a martial artist, I've had my share of brain trauma and sleep deprivation, and Cinequil is their latest brain health supplement. Now, to qualify for the 35% off, go to thorne.com, thorne.com. Click on sign in and then create a new account. You will see the opportunity to register as a first responder or member of military. When you click on that, it will take you through verification with GovX. You'll simply choose a profession, provide one piece of documentation, and then you are verified for life. From that point onwards, you will continue to receive 35% off through Thorne. Now, for those of you who don't qualify, there is still the 10% off using the code BTS10, behind the shield 10, for a one-time purchase. Now, to learn more about Thorne, go to episode 323 of the Behind the Shield podcast with Joel Totoro and Wes Barnett. This episode is sponsored by Team Builder, yet another company that's doing great things for the first responder community. As a strength and conditioning coach myself who also trains tactical athletes, dissemination of wellness information is one of the biggest challenges. Now, Team Builder is the premier strength and conditioning software for tactical athletes. And there are several features that really impress me. Firstly, there is a full exercise library, so you, the personal trainer, does not have to create that within your own department. Secondly, you can send out programming, but also individualize, which I love. So you blanket program for everyone. Now you can tweak based on someone's injury, someone's need to maybe drop some body composition, rather than having to write a program for every single person on their own. Team Builder also allows you to build custom questionnaires to collate health and wellness data. It integrates with wearables. And I think one of the most important things is obviously it tracks. To me, it's imperative that we as a profession start tracking our people from day one and then over the full span of their career, therefore catching potential wellness issues and injuries before they happen. Now, if you want to try Team Builder, they are offering you, the audience of the Behind the Shield podcast, a free 14-day trial to experience all of the features. And if you want to take a deeper dive into Team Builder, listen to episode 1032 with Melissa Mercado, or go to teambuilder.com. And I'll spell that to you because it's not as you'd think. teambuildr.com. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show firefighter and Air National Guardsman Tony Marquez. Now, in this conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from his journey into the fire service, the parallel path into the military, notable calls, and then, in my opinion, the most powerful part of his story, his mental health journey. For people who listen to this podcast a lot, you've probably heard Boulder Crest and the Struggle Well program mentioned many times. Well, Tony takes a deep dive into that program, his experience through Warrior Path, which is the military arm of that, and details the incredible healing power he found through those programs. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single five-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 1,000 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. And one more note, I was sick as a dog with a cold when I did this interview, so I apologize for my voice. That being said,
I introduce to you Tony Marquez. Enjoy. Well, Tony, I want to start by saying thank you so, so much for taking the time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Oh, man, it's a pleasure. It's wild to be here. We were just discussing before we got on here that I reached out to you, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, just random comments on Instagram. And I was like, oh, there's no way this guy's going to reply. And then we started chatting it up for a little bit, lost touch, and got in touch again. And here we are. Pretty cool.
Yeah, no, it's funny because people, you know, there's this almost perception, I think, when you have a platform that you're now some different kind of person and you're not, you know what I mean? You're just a firefighter that just happened to plug a microphone into a computer. That's it. So it's funny yeah. when you hear that. But I think, you know, sadly, obviously, when people get very, very famous, then yeah, this it's so much. Like I see it with some of the actors I've had on the show. I mean, you just gotta be so careful because you don't want to overwhelm them. But no, for any police officer or firefighter behind a microphone, I don't think any of us have that level of fame. So we should be answering all the questions.
Yeah. Well, so many trolls out there, right? Like, oh, what's this guy's angle? What's gonna happen if I respond? But no, it was very cool. And we had like really good chats for a while, and then I don't know what happened, but it's very cool.
Yeah, no, and I think that's the problem. I mean, the old page, there was like 200,000 people on there. And this is the problem is that, yes, you know, from one perspective, okay, that's a larger audience disseminate information, but you also lose the core people that are actually there to make changes, to interact, you know what I mean? So I think that's the sad thing about getting more of a platform is you lose the most valuable people kind of get lost in the white noise there.
Sure. Well, here we are. Very cool.
Exactly. All right. Well, then, so you say here we are. Where on planet Earth are we finding you today?
I am in Tucson, Arizona right now.
Beautiful. Well, I would love to start at the very beginning of your journey. So tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings.
All righty. So I was born in Harvey, Illinois. It's a suburb just south of Chicago. Not the most fun place to grow up in, but I'm sure we'll get into that later. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. She worked in a nursing home, and she got injured there, messed up her back pretty good. So she's on disability and stayed at home. And my dad was in the Navy for a couple years. It's kind of during Vietnam era. I think he did 4, and then he was a firefighter for Harvey, Illinois. So he did 20 years. He had a heart attack and was forced to retire. And then 4 brothers. I'd never call them my half brothers, but since we're getting into it, 2 from my mom's previous marriage, 2 from my dad's previous marriage, and they're all older than me. So I was kind of the young one in the family. And unfortunately, my brother David passed away when he was around 22, and I think I was 12 from cancer. So there's that. That's the family dynamics. My dad passed away in 2019. My mom actually lives with us here in Arizona, along with my father-in-law. So that's the family dynamics.
Yeah, it's so sad because you hear a lot of people that come on the show and their parents were first responders, and more often than not, it's a short lifespan from that generation too.
His kind of sucked. I mean, he had the heart attack and he was still good to go, and I think he was 79 when he passed away. And just I still don't know all the details, but from my understanding is just a mix up of medications and too many blood thinners, and it bled out in his brain because all the crap that he was on from, I mean, he was 79 pushing 80. So he was still fighting strong, but it went down fast. And that's crazy. I know we'll get into it, but that's kind of part of the reason I ended up taking a break from the fire service and going into full-time active duty with the Air National Guard, because when he did pass away, he lived in the district that I work in. So I called 911, and you know, the guys didn't know it was my dad, and they rolled in and they looked at me shocked, and I was like, yeah, it's here. So I got to watch my friends work my dad, and they did what they could do, and he ended up dying in the hospital. But you know, when I went back to the firehouse, I worked in a community where there's older people. So every time I'd go to a call and see someone laying in the bed, all I saw was my dad. I was like, I need a break. And I didn't realize in the moment, that's what it was. But, you know, through the work that I've done, that's what came to fruition.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing you hear with the volunteer fire service. You know, they more often than not, they're working their colleagues, their friends, their, you know, kids they taught, or, you know, school classmates in high school. You know, this is who they're running on. And we don't think about that, you know, in the career side is, you know, not many of us really live and work in the same place these days. A lot of us can't afford to. But yeah, having that proximity and working on your loved ones, I mean, that's another layer of trauma in itself.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I guess real quick, Gordon, if you wanted to talk the path to service, how I got in the military, is that the kind of way you wanted to go?
Well, let's go back. You made the comment about the rough upbringing in Harvey. So to expand on that.
It's funny because I used to hear a lot of jokes of like, hey, if there's criminals running from Chicago, they're going to Harvey. I've heard that before. And then I actually ran into a cop pretty recently because a lot of people from Chicago retire here. They're like, oh, crap, you're from Harvey. I was like, yeah. He's like, oh, okay. Yeah, I was. So because of where my dad worked, he worked for the Harvey Fire Department, and the city mandated that you live where you work. And so a lot of the guys didn't even want to live in Harvey. So some, you know, had fake addresses and lived somewhere else, or they actually lived in the city. So that's why we were forced to live there. But yeah, it was rough. I mean, a lot of drugs, a lot of violence, a lot of gangs, all the things, you know, when I was out in the streets a lot, just running around, because that's just what we did in, you know, in that time frame, riding bikes. And it seemed very safe, but in reality it wasn't. So, you know, especially when my brother passed away, because he was into gangs and drug dealing, unfortunately. And when he passed away, I actually ran into a kid that I played soccer with, and ran into his older brother. And his older brother was like, oh shit, you're David's little brother. And they're wrapped up in the gang, so they kind of took me under their wing for a long time, and kind of got wrapped up in that life pretty early. And it was a rough go.
Talk to me about that crossroads, because I think this is what's so important for people to understand. You know, we have a lot of issues on our streets at the moment, from homelessness to sex work to gangs. And you look at other places in the world and they don't have it anywhere near as rampant as we do in the US. What was that crossroads? Because, you know, there's people that, you know, well, I never went in a gang. Yeah, because, you know, you probably had certain family dynamics and certain mentors in your life that steered you towards the military, the fire service, you know, law, whatever your thing was. But those same mentors can also be in your community, the gangbangers and the drug dealers and those kind of people. So what was kind of, you know, missing up to that point? And then talk to me about that pull for a young boy in Illinois being pulled into that life.
Yeah, like, and again, I know we'll get into it, but all these memories and me figuring this out, you know, came about through my work with therapists, doing the Struggle Well and the Warrior Path, which we'll get into later. But reflecting on it, it wasn't that my dad wasn't there or my mom wasn't there. They were older when they had me, and they did their best. And I wouldn't say there was any neglect there, but the thing that happened was, because my brother was involved with the gangs and the drugs, and we were really close growing up, and he had cancer too. So I remember when he was diagnosed with cancer, he tried to come around, and he wasn't really allowed around the house because there's people looking for him. There's just a lot of danger surrounded him. So when he passed away, it was Super Bowl Sunday, and I remember being left at my parents' friend's house, and they came back and they're like, hey, David passed away. And I never got to say goodbye. There was no closure at all. And there's no closure around actually how he died. Like, was it drug related? Was it overdose? Was it gang related? Was it the cancer? No closure whatsoever. And so, and I didn't get to see him as often as I wanted. So reflecting back, you know, running into guys that hung out with David, that were good friends with David, that loved him, and then me being brought under their wing, like, oh shit, you're David's little brother, let's take care of you, was my way, I think, you know, looking back, is my way to interact with my brother and be with my brother and find that connection. Because as much trouble as they got into and as much things as they did, it was kind of weird because they still wouldn't let me get involved. I was kind of like a hang around almost the whole time because I was so young. I mean, I was 14 years old hanging out with 20, 25 year olds, going to clubs downtown, going to certain bars and parties. And I was just there. And I think I was desperately seeking that connection with my brother that I couldn't have. And these guys were essentially just like him, and trying to find some closure and just trying to fit in, because it's very difficult to fit in where I grew up as well. Because my dad's Mexican descent, my mom's white, predominantly African-American community. So depending on which block I was in, I never fit in. I wasn't full Mexican. I'm not African-American. And I went to a Catholic grade school, and I didn't fit in there because I was literally the only kid from Harvey in that school. So I would ask kids to come over and play, and their parents were like, "Oh, where do you live?" And it's like, "Harvey." I'm like, "Absolutely not. You can come to our house." So yeah, I think that crossroads, just much like you hear all the time, trying to find some type of connection, family, and a group to fit in with. And unfortunately, mine was a little rougher than most groups.
So when you're in this age, and obviously, like you said, this other group was a lot older, what about the sports and exercise? What were you playing and doing back then?
So soccer. Soccer was a big deal. In Chicago, they have this league called CLASA, Chicago Latin American Soccer Association. So all the guys that were in the mix played for this league. And if I remember correctly, all the teams were like a subset of cities in Mexico. So I played for La Piedad. So everyone from La Piedad that lived in that community played for that team. So they're all close-knit, both on the soccer team and then both in the streets as well. So soccer was a big deal. Indoor soccer, outdoor soccer, and then high school soccer. But the indoor and the summer leagues were just that big group, and those became gangs, because then one team didn't like the other, and there were some gnarly rivals. Like, got into a lot of fights on the soccer field for whatever reason.
Yeah, I grew up in the 80s, you know, in England, where we're watching people like stabbing each other and pushing walls on each other over a football team. And it just never made any sense to me. I get it on the pitch, you know, that's where you're actually having this competition. But the fans fighting each other, stabbing each other over a bunch of dudes in shorts, that just never computed with me. That's why I never had a team growing up, because I was just like, that to me, through my lens, was the violence associated rather than the actual game itself.
Yeah, I remember watching a ref get hit in the head with a beer bottle because he made the wrong call. And the game went on. And it was like nothing happened. It was pretty wild.
So what about career aspirations? You're surrounded, obviously, by this kind of street life that you found yourself in. Were there any career dreams that you had at that time?
Oddly enough, like, I always wanted to be like a Navy pilot and go to Annapolis, you know, because Top Gun was big at that time. My dad was in the Navy. My other brother had enlisted into the Navy, and he left. And so that was a big thing, like grade school type-ish. I mean, high school transition is where everything changed. But that was a big thing. And then throughout high school, I didn't try hard enough. I could have done a lot better, as, I mean, we all say we can do. But it was strange. I didn't know what to do. Like, my dad was like, "Hey, you should go in the fire service." He didn't really push it on me, but he mentioned it quite often. And then the military was always kind of there. You know, then you have a girlfriend, you don't want to leave. I got a job, I didn't want to leave the area. So I was kind of in between jobs after high school. And then my brother from my mom's side, they own a company, and they got me in as a union laborer. And if you ever seen that movie, Blues Brothers, where they're flying over the top and you got the steel mills, that's yes. Kind of the area I worked. Yeah, I worked there in East Chicago, Indiana. It's not the steel mill, but it was the where they provide the coal for the steel. And so I was cleaning chutes, doing all the things, making really good money because you're a union worker in the city. So that's a good gig to have. But I'd take about an hour to hour and a half with Vaseline and Q-tips to clean all the coal out of my eyes and ears. And I just remember walking up a ramp and I couldn't breathe. I was like coughing up all this black crap. I was like, I can't do this anymore. So I go to the control room, and one of the guys I knew, he was in the Army. And I was like, "Hey, man," I was like, "what do you think about the military?" I was like, "My brother was in Desert Storm. My dad was in Vietnam. My uncle was in Korea. My grandfather was in World War II. There's a lot of service." I was like, "What do you think about it?" And it's funny because he was like, he's like, "Hey, man, there's no wars going on right now, and there probably won't be any. So don't go in the Marines or Army. Go in the Navy or the Air Force. You can learn a trade." I was like, "All right, Air Force sounds cool." And then went in the Air Force. So, I mean, I think that was like a Monday. That Wednesday, I enlisted, and then I shipped out. And then went to tech school, did all the boot camp and all the things. And my second day of work was 9/11, and everything changed after that.
Before we progress forward, I meant to ask you this before. With the Vietnam generation, unlike, you know, the World War II, and I would argue the last 20 years or so, that generation specifically was so poorly received when they came back home. And I've heard so many horror stories, people being pissed on and spit on and all these other things. What are some, if any, of the stories that you remember from your father's experience in Vietnam?
Zero. He would always say one cool, funny story that when before he went into country, he was in Japan. And because he actually looks kind of Asian, so a lot of guys thought he was Japanese. And so the Japanese mafia actually took him under his wing at this one bar. And like he would just hang out with them. And some Marines would come in and start a fight with him. And the Japanese guys would protect him because they called him, I don't know if this is a derogatory term. I don't mean it that way. But he said they would call him Nisi Boy. And I don't know what that means. But that's what they said they would call him. And like he was like a friend of theirs. He would tell me that. And then he would tell me how my uncle was in the Air Force and my dad spent more time in planes than my uncle did in the Air Force. My uncle spent more time on ships than my dad did. And that's the extent of the military stuff that he would talk about. He wouldn't talk about it at all.
Yeah. A lot of them, I think, just bottled it in.
Yeah. But talking through my mom with some of these problems, that, you know, again, stuff that I learned through Warrior Path and the Struggle Well, I actually had some open conversations with my mom, and she brought up that my dad had some significant events happen in Vietnam, and she didn't really elaborate either, but I guess he went through some pretty gnarly stuff and took some lives and was in the mix, but he just never talked about it. And I don't know if he talked about it with my brother either.
I mean, I just can't imagine, you know, whether, you know, you enlist or whether you were drafted to go out there, fight with, you know, the American flag on your shoulder, do the things that your country asks for you to do, whether people back home agree with it or not. And then you come back and, you know, that's the environment that you return. So there's no, you know, you listen to Sebastian Junger talking about the Native Americans coming back from war. There was storytelling and you know, mm-hmm. rituals and all these kind of things and a celebration for the warriors returning. To come back to such a, you know, betrayal basically by the country on those actual men and women that were out there, regardless of the politics, how absolutely crushing that must have been for our men and women in uniform.
Yeah, absolutely. In some of my studies through the social work and other studies, they also, you know, I don't have all the details, but they talked about, again, like the World War II guys. I mean, they had 2 to 3 weeks coming back on ships and they had a lot of time together to decompress before they got home. And then Vietnam guys, I mean, they're home almost instantly. And Desert Storm and the GWAT guys, you know, you one plane and you're home pretty quick with not a lot of time to decompress, and you're thrusted into a whole different world that you know, yesterday I was just getting shot at, today I'm, you know, at the supermarket, and that's a lot to deal with in such a short time.
It's amazing when I ask these early life questions, a lot of times it's either father, if it's an older guest, or grandfather was a World War II veteran. And, you know, we've romanticized those guys. You know, they came back, they rolled up their sleeves and they got back to work, greatest generation. And they were hands down the greatest generation for the courage and sacrifice they made, you know, fighting true tyranny overseas. But actually, when you hear the, you know, the children's version of how dad was, they did struggle. They struggled immensely. But we almost, you know, close the door for them to be able to talk about their struggles. Like, usually, no, don't ruin everything. You're the greatest generation. You took care of it. And they didn't. You know, a lot of them were, you know, it was alcoholism and domestic abuse and all these other things, just like we see with our firefighters and cops and the military members more recently. Like, you can't go overseas and do that and then come home. And like you said, now you're, you know, working in construction and just bury the fact that, you know, you discovered Auschwitz, or, you know, you had to kill a German with a rock in the middle of Holland somewhere and just bury that down and not talk about it again. So it's interesting when, you know, you hear these actual family stories that we need to give grace to that generation and understand that they did struggle, and rightly so.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. My mom speaks about that as well. My grandfather coming back and certain things that happened in her childhood as well, which you can easily relate. I mean, you spent how many years in World War II? And I'd venture to say World War II is pretty rough as well, because from readings I've had and things that I've looked up is, like, when you were deployed, you weren't coming back until it was done. Like, sometimes you have, like, hey, you're gone for, you almost have, like, a timeline. Like, you're going to get here and leave here. And a lot of times that doesn't happen. But those guys and gals were like, yeah, we'll see you when it's over, and could spend years out there. That's rough.
Absolutely. Well, we stopped at 9/11, so you're now in the Air Force. You've gone through your training. Talk to me how that day unfolded through your eyes, and then let's kind of walk through what happened next in your career.
Ooh, that was a crazy day. So my first job was military intelligence, and I had got stationed at a headquarters building in Scott Air Force Base, Illinois, which is funny because I wanted to go all overseas, get out of Illinois, all the things, and I get my orders, and it said, Scott Air Force Base, Illinois. I was like, where the hell is this at? And so I go home on leave, collect all my stuff, and drive down. And I had never been out of the city or a suburb, so I thought Illinois was one big city and the rest was suburbs. So I'm driving through cornfields and all the things. So that was a shock within itself. But I just remember that day sitting in the vault, and you know, we'd have camera or TVs with the news going on. And there was this pretty big secure vault. And the first plane hit, and I remember the lieutenant was like, Marquez, get over here. And we were watching it. We're like, and we didn't realize it was a big plane. And, you know, people were like, oh man, some air traffic controllers getting fired today. Like, how does that happen? Like, what the hell? And then the second one hit, and it was like dead silence. And then the phone started ringing and everyone just scattered. The base shut down. There's Humvees everywhere with 50 cals mounted. It was like game on. And just, it got real busy real fast. And I was in charge of these certain kits that we'd send out, communication kits, and started shipping those out real quick. Nobody knew what the hell was going on. We just knew that something was going to happen real soon. So it got busy real quick. And then I had requested to deploy right away. And they're like, well, your upgrade training's not done. So hurried up with my upgrade training and all the things. And because I worked for AMC, Air Mobility Command, so it's the big cargo planes, there weren't any in country. There's some, but not the ones that we dealt with. So I got sent to Ramstein like five times to go do the intel briefs for the planes going back and forth from in country, just giving them their threat briefs and escape and evasion charts and updating all their information in case something happened.
Ramstein's Germany?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all that was the main hub.
So where did that lead you?
So I was at Scott for about 3 years, went to Spain a few times, Germany, a bunch of other places, Turkey, Kuwait, all kinds of stuff, just doing those intel briefs, doing training stuff. And then my boss was like, hey, man, you got to get out of Illinois. You got to get to another place. And I went to Korea, Kunsan Air Base, for a year and worked with the fighters. And that was a whole other crazy experience. That was at the time when North Korea started doing their nuclear tests, and being in that mix and almost being on edge the whole time, where nothing's really happening right now, but it could. And if it does, it's going to go real bad real quick. And I think that started the real like mental health type issues, because when I was at Scott, I was only 4 hours away from home, so I could go home and see my buddies. But then I'm in Korea for a year, completely isolated from anybody, can't go home, all the things. And drinking was big there. I mean, there was a lot of drinking going on in Korea. And so what we did, we worked and drank, because you couldn't have your families there either. It was a remote tour. So folks that were married and had kids are there alone as well. So you got really close. It was a really close-knit community, but also there's a lot of drinking involved, which didn't help the isolation of being away from family and whatnot. And it was a very high tempo ops as well. So it was good. It was cool. Learned a lot, but it was definitely, I feel like that was the start of my struggles. Well, I guess exposing said struggles from even earlier in childhood.
It's interesting. I saw a documentary on people trying to escape North Korea. And there was a graphic which I'd seen actually shared on the internet before. But it showed, you know, the advance of the North Koreans through Korea and how like close they were to be completely overrun. And our, you know, the Americans and the Allies pushed them from like the very tip of Korea all the way back to the point that we know today. And again, it's so sad because that's the kind of, as they say, the forgotten war. The heroism of that generation is also not really acknowledged by our country.
No, not at all. And I would have to give some of the intel briefs to the newcomers and just talk about how, you know, if things shake out, what it looks like. And it was kind of a scary brief. And I would tell him, he's like, hey, we're going to win the war, but we're not going to be around for the parade. Like, we're just a speed bump for the people in Korea. Like, if this kicks off, it's going to get ugly real quick.
What about Korean culture? When, you know, one of the big kind of through lines of this podcast is literally having guests from around the world, and so many countries, there's areas that they do really well that I think if we knowledge shared and had the humility to ask each other, we could, you know, the rising tide lifts all ships, you know, the whole planet could elevate. Were there any things about Korean culture or kind of technologies or anything else that they had over there that you were kind of thinking, wow, this is pretty impressive?
Not so much like technology or anything like that. Unfortunately, I was in those young stages, so I just hung around the bars and that type of scene. But the culture was really cool. I really enjoyed it. They had a program in Kunsan where you can help teach English to Korean students, to children. And that was an amazing experience. So I would do that mostly on the weekends, mostly Saturday mornings. And you would go to the school, hang out with these kids for a couple hours, help them with their English and whatnot. And then the teachers would take you to traditional restaurants or to their home and teach you about culture. And everywhere they took you was a place that typically Americans or foreigners did not go. And that was an incredible experience. I love that. And I got to go volunteer at a Catholic nursing home in Korea, which was super cool. Like, we learned how to make kimchi from scratch. That was a really amazing experience. So just the friendliness and the accepting was really cool. And just like anywhere else, the older community really embraced, from what I saw, a lot of the Americans, because of the Forgotten War. And some kids, you know, you get some college kids that were against us being there. But overwhelmingly, it was a very positive experience with the culture and whatnot. And, you know, I tried to learn a little bit of the language, and it was difficult, but I'm all in on the Korean food and bulgogi and kimchi, and overall is a great experience. If I would love to go back and do more of the more sightseeing and seeing some of what it has to offer. Like going to the DMZ was an incredible experience. You go into like the meeting house, and you technically go to North Korea. When you go into the meeting house, you cross the blue line and you hurry up and run around the table, and seeing just the standoff with the Korean soldiers and the North Korean soldiers just standing there, literally staring at each other for hours on end, just, you know, like a little mini show of force. But no, I loved it. You know, all the places I've been to were phenomenal, like Germany and all around Europe and Spain, and even Turkey was pretty cool. Qatar, all the places I had really good experiences. I didn't, nothing negative to say about those at all.
It's interesting seeing how much Korean culture has blown up in the West now. I mean, if you look on Netflix, there's so many, you know, Korean shows and films, and then we have K-pop. And, you know, when I remember the I think it was J-pop when I lived in Japan like 20 plus years ago, but it was more then an adoration for the West, even though actually, like, you know, many areas, technology and fashion, they were way ahead of us. It was the other way around. But now I feel like it's side by side. Like all these artists, you know, are collaborating with each other, and it's so good to see that the internet has kind of merged a lot of these countries, which is in a beautiful way.
Yeah, that's one of the benefits of like social media and the internet, just the positive connections that can be made, and you can definitely see it through the sharing of cultures, which is super cool. And I remember going to like a fake Pizza Hut and a fake Starbucks, you know, the logo, but it really wasn't, and stuff like that. Seeing that adoption of American culture throughout the communities and the cities was pretty funny and cool.
Yeah, it's sad as well, because you think about North Koreans, and again, we only get the images that are sent, but, you know, this adoration of the leader and this, you know, these parades for them, and, you know, obviously the propaganda that they're fed. Forget the West, but just their brothers and sisters to the South. These are the same people. And, you know, if you allow a tyrant to rise, and I know the origin obviously was post World War II, but how tragic it is that you can divide. I mean, look at even, you know, East and West Berlin. You can just simply put a barrier or a wall up, and you can actually condition people to hate each other, even though they're the same people.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy to see, for sure.
All right. Well, then after Korea, walk me through what happens next.
So I was in Korea, and I was supposed to have a follow-on tour to England, and I was working with fighter pilots in Korea. Didn't have the best experience. I just don't think I was good enough, to be quite honest, to work with them, because they're so high speed. And so I denied my follow-on to England, and I went back to working with the heavy aircraft, the AMC command. So I ended up in McGuire Air Force Base in New Jersey. And that's when I kind of started my firefighter journey. Like, I started really talking to my dad about the fire department, because I realized, like, sitting in an office, especially vaults with no windows, just something was missing. And he'd always talk about how much he loved the job, but he didn't push it. It was just little snapshots here and there. And I started remembering going to the station and how cool it was and how fun it was meeting the guys. And when I was home on leave, my dad had already been retired, and starting to hang out with him and going to retirement parties from guys that I remember when I was really little, and just seeing the camaraderie, I was like, man, this is really cool. I like what this is about. So when I went to New Jersey, I actually started volunteering at the local volunteer fire department in Lumberton, New Jersey. So I went to their academy at night and started volunteering with them, because I figured, I was like, well, let me start slow. If I volunteer and I like it, well, then obviously I should pursue it. And if I don't, then it was a good test with, I don't want to say minimal effort, but minimal risk, right? I didn't have to leave anything to get into it. So fell in love with it quickly. And then I actually changed jobs in the Air Force to become an Air Force firefighter. So after McGuire, I went to the Department of Defense Fire Academy in Goodfellow, Texas. And then got stationed in Davis-Monthan in Tucson. So that's why I'm here. So I was here for about 2 years. I got out of active duty and got a civilian firefighter job out here and just stuck around. I started off at Tohono O'odham Indian Nation and then moved to where I'm at now.
What were the idiosyncrasies about the military firefighting that, you know, are different to the civilian side?
There wasn't much difference, but the thing that made the Air Force Fire Department weird was obviously the focus on protecting the runways and aircraft. You know, that the ARF side of it was significantly different, but it was a very cool, weird experience, because they, at least the fire, because I only have experience at one Air Force fire department, but it was treated like a civilian fire department, where it was based on your position on the truck of your of the hierarchy, you know. And so I came in as an E5 staff sergeant, you know, non-commissioned officer, but I was the new guy. So I was sitting backwards. So although I outranked the guy driving, it didn't matter, because I was the new firefighter. So like, your military rank didn't matter. It was all about your position on the truck. So that was kind of like a weird thing to navigate, like trying to fit in that role. And then the schedules aren't that great, because there's less shifts. So we're 24 on, 24 off with a Kelly day. So I think it equated to like a 6-3, 6-24 is on, and then you got 3 days off. Other than that, it's fairly similar, because you have base housing, you have buildings to worry about, just adding in, you know, trying to figure out how to cut out a pilot out of a fighter jet, or egressing that, or shutting down aircraft, which is pretty scary when they're running and you got to jump, you know, do some emergency procedures and chalk and tires and whatnot while there's a huge engine over your head. That's a little scary, but other than that, it was pretty similar.
I've had a few Air Force firefighters on the show. There's one side where, you know, they're on the space pretty much as soon as the aircraft stops landing, they're pretty much good for the rest of the night. And then you've got others that are almost, you know, acting like a municipal department. They're running calls through the night. Which of those two kind of sides was yours more familiar with?
I was both, because there was two stations. So there's one right on the flight line, which primarily dealt with the aircraft things. And there's one that was closer to base housing that did the housing. But yeah, it just depended where the call was, whatever closest was. So if there was, if there's somebody working a 24-hour shift, let's say in the command post, and it was next to the flight line, well, if they had a medical emergency, we went. So it was both. Yeah. They always said, though, the primary focus would be the flight line. Like, if a plane was coming in, emergency, and there's a house fire, we're going to the plane first, and the local fire department could take care of the house fire. But yeah, it was a nice combination of both.
Well, you mentioned about being on a Native American reservation. Again, this is another kind of group of people I don't think get the kind of exposure and conversations that they need. You have obviously this kind of native heritage, and then, you know, this loss of tribe, literally in this term, where, you know, some of these tribes were smited from the states. And then I also hear about poverty, desperation, addiction in some of these areas too. What was your experience in that particular place you worked?
It was incredible. I loved it. You know, unfortunately, ego and not understanding how things really work made me leave, right? I was like, oh, we're sitting in this single wide trailer with just 2 to 3 of us fighting this fire. I should go to a big city department and really get after it. But I fought more fire there than I did at the fire department I'm at now. I don't regret the move, but yeah, there was a lot of sadness there as well. And the culture and some trust issues as well, which I completely understand. You know, they did a bunch of hiring and there's a lot of non-natives that were hired, and it took a lot of effort to fit in. And, you know, and I understood, and I think that was a benefit of my military experience is being in different cultures. Like, hey, look, this isn't your home. Don't come in here and think it is, or try to run things just because you got hired onto the fire department. These guys have been here longer than you. They know the culture. They know the language. They know the area. You need to fit in and be humble. And it was an awesome experience. It took a lot of time to learn the culture, go to the different events, and it took a little bit of time, but I feel like I've built some trust while I was there and really integrated myself as much as I could.
Please carry on.
And then the crazy thing is it's a pretty big nation. It's the size of Connecticut, I believe, with 4 stations. So sometimes our response times are like 45 minutes, which is pretty wild. And then it borders Mexico, and there's kind of almost like free passing because a lot of the natives extend into Mexico. So that same tribe has tribal members in Mexico as well. But there was also a lot of the drug trafficking or immigration and whatnot. So summers were rough. I have a lot of bad memories of running on people that were simply trying to find a better way, got lost in the desert and needed help. But, you know, sometimes it was too late and sometimes it was right on time. And I had some scary ones too. I remember going to a wildland fire at night, and we had to be escorted by Border Patrol. And he was sitting there just racking his AR-15, making noise. And he looked over at me. He's like, you know why I'm doing that? I was like, I have no idea why you're doing that. He's like, look in the mountains and you see these little spotlights, because they're spotters for the people running drugs. I was like, oh, got it. So he wanted them to know that we were there. And, you know, we leave the lights on the fire truck on purpose so they know we're there and whatnot. So sometimes it's a little hairy, but yeah, it's definitely interesting for sure.
So what kind of town, city did you find yourself as far as the dynamic of your current department?
The current one is, we have 10 stations, so it's in the town of Oro Valley. So not as big as a city, so a nice size municipality, I guess, like a suburb type deal.
Mm-hmm. So as you...
And it's pretty cool. While I was away on military orders, they started automatic aid with another town's fire department and then Tucson fire department, trying to almost mirroring what Phoenix does with that automatic aid, where it doesn't matter what it says on your truck, whoever's closer goes. So it kind of turned into a really big department pretty quick.
Have you had the chance to figure out how they did that? Because when I worked in Anaheim, for example, that's what we had. And we even trained together. There was a couple of training centers and all the neighboring departments would come in and we'd do drills and we'd do class time. And, you know, you go on a fire and yeah, you just, as you said, however many engines you need, right? 3 Anaheim, 2 Fullerton, whatever it is. And we make this complement. I've worked in other places where county and city won't even talk to each other, which nauseates me. I mean, if you have that kind of narcissism in your leadership, then you need a clean house. When you kind of think back, what were the things that were put in place to allow the humility and the leadership in your area to create such a great relationship?
Yeah, it's a good question that I don't know. You know, I was either at the engineer or captain level when that happened. We just knew it was in the talks, but I think we're kind of spoiled being close to Phoenix. And from my understanding, they're the ones that really implemented that into the Valley. So I think just the Arizona Chiefs Council got together, figured out how Phoenix did it, and then Tucson Fire, Northwest Fire, and our fire department just got together. It was like, hey, how do we make this happen? And they just made it happen. So I don't know how long it took. I don't know the ins and outs, but from the outside looking in, it seemed pretty seamless. But again, we don't know what talks are being had between district members, board members, city council, and all that goodness.
Brilliant. I'm actually about to interview John Brunacini soon, so I'll ask him.
Yeah, he may or may not have some insight on that.
All right. Well, then let's kind of go, before we hit the mental health side, Yeah. When you reflect back now as a firefighter, now a municipal firefighter, what were some of the career calls? And then if there's any that you want to weave in that actually contributed to, you know, the downwards spiral that you encountered?
Yeah, it's interesting to say that because it will dovetail nicely with the Struggle Well course and the Warrior Path. There's probably two main calls that really stick out in my head. Like New Year's Eve will never be the same. So I remember getting toned out like right at midnight. Like you look at your watch, it's like, is this a movie? Right at midnight. And it was a 17-year-old kid that got stabbed in the heart. And it was kind of like through gang violence. So I remember getting there and pulling him out of this big bonfire. And I remember all our looking back, you know, after we did our after action, like a lot of our gear was burned because it fell in the fire, but there was a lot of animosity, like, yeah, that's what you get, you know, almost like cheering on this death. And I just remember doing compressions and the blood coming out of his chest. I was like, there's no way. And his uncle being there because it was a small community. And I just remember him, you know, passing away in the firehouse. And as soon as he got back in the truck, it was just another call. Like we left the station at midnight. We didn't get back till I think 4 or 5. So no time to sleep, no time to decompress, no time to talk about it. And we just didn't talk about it. So that one sticks out in my mind a lot. And then there was one where we saved a guy and, you know, we were all excited and pulled him out of the car, pretty gnarly accident. And, you know, we found out later that the family was kind of upset because now he has the brain capacity of a 5-year-old. So it's almost like he would have been better off dead because although we saved his life, he was in such a bad way that he doesn't really have a quality of life anymore. So that one stings a lot. And then, I remember opening up a semi truck that Border Patrol called us on, and we opened up the door and there's just a bunch of people crossing the border, a bunch of immigrants there. And one young girl, I think she was 20 years old, died of hyperthermia, and we couldn't bring her back. So those are the big ones that stand out to me. But I think pairing that as far as with the mental health and the Struggle Well and the Warrior Path was that I just didn't have any ways to deal with it. There was no ways to process that. There was no wellness practices involved other than, hey, let's go get a beer. Let's go meet up at the, you know, 07 in the morning and get a 6-pack type deal. That's the only way to deal with it. And like my friend Molly, she was telling me that she instructs at the local community college and she likes to talk about the mental health aspect as of, you know, we're seeing recruiting hurting and PD and military and fire. And it's because we hear a lot about post-traumatic stress disorder. We hear a lot about no sleep. We hear all the bad things associated with the firehouse. And although we got to take some responsibility and ownership is what she's trying to teach them is, yeah, these things are going to happen. You're signing up for trauma, but you also have a choice of, hey, am I going to go get hammered because this happened? Or am I going to go for a hike or call somebody or talk about it or do some meditation? Like what wellness practices are you doing and prepared to do when these things happen, as opposed to just throwing your hands up and like, I have no idea what to do.
Yeah. And I think that's the problem we've had with this conversation is a lot of times I've seen people put it on the shoulders of the firefighter. You know, when you get home, you know, your sleep hygiene and this and this and this. The answer is both. Yes, we absolutely have to have, you know, ownership and understand the value of our sleep. And, you know, when you're reaching for a beer, asking yourself why, and like you said, could a walk or a meditation or a swim or a cold plunge, you know, take away that urge? But we've also got to look at the working environment, you know, and I think that the way you process trauma is sleep, you know, so we have to look at the way that we work our firefighters and say, is this working? Is this the right environment? And I know I beat a dead horse talking about this, but you know, this is what I don't see departments doing is looking in the mirror and going, what are we doing wrong? It's always, mm-hmm. You know, even with the cancer, oh, it's the PFAS now is the latest thing. Well, that's still you pointing away from yourself. You know, sleep deprivation is also a carcinogen. I know departments that never run fire that have lost numerous firefighters to cancer. So if it was just the carcinogens, then be easy fix. But yeah, so I think it's such an important conversation that we address both simultaneously, because then you'll have a double effect.
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely takes a team effort for sure. You know, it's easy to blame the environment, easy to blame the individual. It's easy to point fingers. It's really hard to to put in extra work to see how we could really figure this out. You're never going to figure it out perfectly, but sure as hell can make some different strides to make it better for sure.
Yeah.
And really, the schedule, it's crazy, right? Cause I remember my dad, you know, this is the best schedule in the world. And we look at it like, well, is it? so it has its benefits, especially at slower stations, but at a busy station, you know, stand up 24s for me and then getting home and trying to operate is not fun.
No. No. And again, I put a post out a little while ago. I did the math where I figured out how many days a year a Monday to Friday person works, you know, and it was 260 days a year because they have the weekends off. And that's before, obviously, vacation. If you factor an 8-hour day as a firefighter, so that's apples to apples, it equates to 364 days a year. So you get a day off every year. That's it. So, I mean, I've been harping about this. We do not have a great schedule unless you're listening and you do a four platoon system, and then it's much better. Still not great because civilians that don't save lives work 40 hours a week, but yeah, you know, a lot better than a 56, but yeah, I mean, we have to debunk that myth because it's just completely wrong.
Yeah. And guaranteed sleep, right? We might get some sleep, but the 40-hour jobs, even if you're working shift work, which isn't very healthy, you're still at least guaranteed a chunk where if you can sleep, you won't get it won't get interrupted.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you talked about some of the traumas. You talked about, you know, working your father, well, initially working your father and then watching your crew. Where was the lowest place that you found yourself? And then let's walk through how you found Boulder Crest.
Ooh, I mean, this journey started a long time ago, probably around, I would say, sometime after when I got back from Korea and started working in New Jersey at that Air Force base. Just something was off. Always angry, tired, drinking was top of mind. You know, the bad habits, the addictions, whether that was porn, womanizing, boozing, whatever, bad decisions, just something going on. So that started then, and a lot of, I guess, bad relationship decisions and just being an asshole just across the board, whether it was with friends or intimate relationships, and just not being a good dude. And so I started getting a little bit of help, and this is what actually led me into social work as well, finishing up that degree. Is I remember I was like, all right, I'm going to start getting help. And I went to one therapist, and I told her the stories that I shared here and a few others. I'm just going to spare you the details, but she got up crying and left the room and then came back and was like, okay, we're done here. I was like, oh, sweet. All right, this is how this works. And then I remember going to another therapist, and he gave me like a bunch of like homework and asked me some random questions. And he ended it with like, do you wish your parents were dead? I was like, not really, but I don't know where we're going with this. So I was like, all right, we're done here. So I was like completely turned off from that. And then witnessing three different firefighter buddies, two were told, hey, it's too hard for you. You should just retire. And they're really good firefighters. So they did, because they didn't give them any ways out. And then another one was told that, hey, when those calls that trigger you ring out, just don't go. He's like, that's not how this works. I can't just not want a call. And so that happened. And then I don't know how I got turned on to the therapist I ended up finding, but she had worked specifically with first responders and veterans. And that was, that's what opened the door. I was like, okay, this might actually work. And then that came around the same time of meeting my wife and Yella. And when I met her, I was like, I knew she's the one, like no questions asked, like this is going to work. And I was like, well, I got to really un-F myself if I want to make this work. And so that's when I started really hammering out all these issues and whatnot. So yeah, I think it's just been a long time coming. And I finally realized that, you know, and when I talked to people, I was like, yeah, you know, I was 14, you know, hanging out with a bunch of gang members, going to parties, drinking. Isn't that normal? And they're like, no, it's not normal. And then and when the therapist was like, tell me about your childhood, I was like, I don't remember much before 17. She's like, yeah, that's a problem. So when I was like actually starting to figure out that whatever normal is, it is what it is. It's all relative. But what I was going through, what I was thinking, and the things that happened to me, I wouldn't say aren't normal or normal. They were normal for where I grew up, but they were having significant impact on who I was and my health mentally and my way to be and getting in the way of me being a better person for sure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's funny if you think about it, you know, a child growing up in a nuclear family in suburbia somewhere, and the parents actually are madly in love with each other. Yeah, that's their normal. A little child growing up in Gaza at the moment, that's their normal. Two very different normals. So normal doesn't necessarily mean healthy.
Yeah, exactly. Because, yeah, it's all relative for sure.
Absolutely. All right. Well, then how did you find Bouldercrest? And let's start talking about the program that you went through.
All right. So at first, I've taken all the critical incident stress management, the compassion fatigue classes, all the CBTs we got to do in the military, the same in the fire, all the assist training and suicide trainings, like how to help somebody else, how to look for your friend, make sure your buddy's taken care of, make sure your wingman's taken care of, all those courses. And my commander at the time, he went through the Struggle Well course because he was friends with someone at Tucson Police Department. And apparently Tucson Police Department and Miami Police Department are the vanguards of the Struggle Well portion of Bouldercrest, which is specifically focused, I think it was on law enforcement. Now it's reaching out to fire, and then it's reaching all first responders. So he went to that course, and he knew I was very invested into mental health. And he was like, hey, bro, you should go to this course. And it's funny, I think I told him this, but I guess we'll find out. But I was like, no, I'm way too busy. I'm good. Because in my mind, I was like, I'm not going through another resiliency course. Like, they're not, like, what is going to make this different? He's like, okay, cool. And another one came up. He's like, hey, I'm not really asking you this time. You're going to go. I was like, fine. So I go into the Struggle Well course. And day one, I was like, oh, here we go. It's the same crap over and over again. And then when we really got into it and really got into the work, nothing they teach is new. Nothing they teach is cosmic or nothing we've heard before, but just the way they packaged it, the way they made it about, like, how can Tony help Tony? How can James help James? Instead of, hey, Tony, make sure James is okay, and he'll make sure you're okay, and then you both will be okay. I was like, no shit. Like, how can you reflect on yourself, reflect on your day-to-day, reflect on your past, understand that there are traumas that happened, but what goodness can you get out of there? And so that's how I got exposed to Bouldercrest, through the Struggle Well course, which was phenomenal. And I thought that was like the capstone. I tell everyone, hey, like, this is my capstone of my mental health journey. And then I did some guiding. So they don't really call them instructors. They call them guiding. And I guided with two other individuals, and they're like, hey, you need to go to Warrior Path. I was like, nah, that's not for me. I didn't feel worthy to go. Like, I didn't feel like I did enough as far as the combat side of the house. I'm like, nah, you need to go. And I went through that, and man, that was like Struggle Well on steroids, and it was absolutely phenomenal. Like, that one really pushed me over the edge from the things I learned. And the biggest takeaway from the Struggle Well, they do this really cool thing where they put up a graph, and they're like, hey, in your job, so if I were to ask you, James, in your job as a firefighter, do you think it was good to be hypervigilant and understand your surroundings and have situational awareness?
Yes.
Answer, yes. Is it good to have attention to detail, you know, making sure your hose lays are good to go, making sure your air pack is above 40? And yes. And, you know, things like that. Boom, 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 boom. Is it good to have all these things? You're like, absolutely. But then they flip the script, and then they put the DSM-5 symptoms of PTSD. You know, hypervigilant, always looking around, easily upset if something's not correct. All these things are like, holy shit. So they made a parody of like, this is the training you got to do your job, and this is how it bleeds over to your everyday life. And you need to install a dimmer switch of when to turn that on and off. Instead of just on and off, when can you turn it up and turn it down? And then they go into how your training growing up, like, were you trained to shut up and color in your house because you were scared? Were you trained to be overly aggressive because of the neighborhood you grew up in? Like, was it feast or famine? Did you have to be the strong one to fight? Well, that's your training. So nothing's good, nothing's bad. It's just how you were trained. And now once you get an understanding of how you were trained, both professionally and in your childhood, then you can understand why these things happen and install that dimmer switch. And that was remarkable for me. That just that little exercise was incredible.
Talk to me a little bit more about unpacking your childhood. I think one of the mistakes that a lot of the general conversation make is, oh, PTSD, oh, it's because you had that call, you know, that decapitated child, that gangbanger, whatever it was. And when you actually dive in, as you have done, into this world, you realize that, you know, for example, the ACEs, the adverse child adverse childhood experience score, excuse me, a lot of us supposedly are at 6 out of 10. A lot of the incarcerated population are at 6 out of 10. You know, there's that crossroads for us. So understanding that a lot of the reasons that we even put the uniform on are because of our childhood, which I would argue is great if you've processed those traumas, not so good if you've kind of stuffed them down. So what were some of the aha moments? Because you've touched on it a couple of times, that was really when you kind of were looking that far back, as far as being taking the spotlight off your career and actually shining it to your formative years.
Yeah, absolutely. That was the most incredible thing, because all those calls were bad, right? I guess they didn't have the impact that I thought they would have on me, especially when I didn't, before I had my daughter. I remember going on Pete's calls and I'm like, hey, I'll take care of it. It doesn't bother me. I don't have kids. And I thought being numb was my superpower. Like it helped a lot, quite actually. So what made me realize that it's more than just the calls or in our duty was doing studies for social work. One study was talking about combat veterans, Marines, and they talked about how, like, hey, I was doing my job in combat. That's not the problem, because that's when they started figuring out, like, no, it's the childhood thing. And much like you said, there was a study that was brought up at Warrior Path where the majority of people that enlist have the high ACEs scores. Majority of first responders have the high ACEs scores because they want to, whether it's consciously or subconsciously, they want to go into an environment to protect others because they were not protected themselves. So yes, we sign up for trauma when we do these jobs. And yes, in a typical life, you'll see your grandparents pass away, your parents pass away, maybe your brother, sister, maybe uncle, and down the line, like a parent should never bury their child, so on and so forth. But in the first responder world, military world, you're going to see all that trauma like within a year, like maybe five times over. But going back to the childhood thing, so in Struggle Well, they talked about, they have this Tony Robbins video, and it said, if you're going to blame them for all the bad, you got to blame them for all the good. And that helped. And then there was also unpacking your rucksack, like figuring out the goodness out of the bad things that happened. So they talked about that. And that's when I started reflecting back, because when I was, gosh, I think it was like 8 or 9, I remember going down the street and playing Street Fighter video games, tournaments. Like, I was awesome at it, you know, all day. And out of nowhere, one of my friends was like, hey, come over here. And he showed me a gun, showed me a revolver, explained that having a revolver is better because it holds the shells, and then showed me crack. And then sold it to the neighbor. We watched the neighbor get high, like their mom, and it was a pretty bad experience. And fast forward like a week later, there was the older brother came back from jail. And he's like, oh, you think that's funny? I'm going to show you what jail's like. And I was sexually assaulted at a young age. And the Struggle Well made me realize, like, maybe that's why I never sold drugs. Maybe that's why I never did anything illegal. Because I remember my answer when, hey, do you want to sell this stuff that fell off a truck? Do you want to sell those drugs? Do you want to do this, do that? And I was like, no, I don't want to go to jail. So it's like peeling back that, I was like, oh, that's a gem I could find out of that rock. Because that really crappy thing happened to me, but it prevented me from doing things to go to jail because I was scared to death to go to jail because of that experience. So learning that. And then Warrior Path may help me process my brother's death as well, and made me realize, like, that was the focal point of all this childhood stuff. So now when I go back to the firehouse in Maine, now with my work in the military, I'm like, I have all these wellness practices. I have a solid understanding of why certain things trigger me, why certain things are upsetting to me because of the past. And now I'm able to process it a little better, as opposed to pointing fingers. And another thing it did for me is it made me realize that, you know, I had a lot of shame and guilt. I did a lot of bad things to people I cared about. I'm really good at isolating and shutting people off and all the things. And those are all just defense mechanisms. And it taught me not to do that, and taught me to get away from that, and to really build that trust and connection and have some good friends. So, I mean, it just all like just came together. And really, yeah, the childhood stuff was a big deal to process all that and get me to a better place. And I don't think the traumas exposed in the firehouse and military were what made me do bad decisions. I think those were crutches, because I could also use it as a crutch, like, hey, I'm treating you bad because I had it bad, or I'm getting hammered every night because of this, and it should be okay, you should just leave me alone. That's not the case. And yeah, just figuring out why things, what's what, where the training came from, and how to stop it is probably the most important things that I've learned.
I was really taken aback how many men especially were sexually abused when they were young. It's been on this podcast, so a lot of them in uniform. I think it's you know, woefully underappreciated how frequent it is, you know, and obviously the kind of curtain's being pulled back a little bit more, and this kind of sexual predator thing has been put into the center stage. But our generation and before, like, I've heard so many stories of men who have been molested, who became firefighters, cops, soldiers. And if that is put in, you talk about guilt and shame, you know, a lot of them, it was only when they realized that they were a victim of this, they stopped blaming themselves. You know, what did I do? You know, did I must have been, you know, the reason that they did that. And like, no, you were, it's okay to, in that situation, just be a victim. You were young, you were preyed upon, and this happened. But that is an extremely toxic cancer that's buried in that chest for some of our men and women.
Yeah, absolutely. And going through these courses and learning that as well, and hearing other people's stories, and like, I talked to one guy and I was like, it's really shitty, but it's also kind of, in a weird way, good, because then you're not alone. Like, you don't wish it upon anybody, but you also don't want to be the only one. Like, it's just kind of a weird dynamic, right? Like, it helps, I think, both of us heal, and like, hey, we're not the only one. And this does happen. And like you said, you're just a little kid. Like, you look back, and that's one thing that one of the therapists brought up, was like, you have a scared little child inside of you, but you're a grown man and you're trying to keep both safe. And that's a very difficult thing to do. And just forgiving yourself and having that grace, like, it's not your fault. It legitimately was not my fault. Like, I didn't ask for it. And I sure as hell couldn't protect myself as a little 9-year-old against a huge man. So yeah, it's rough going, but just facing those demons and getting after it and getting after the help and realizing you're not alone is powerful.
Absolutely. Well, another area that I talk about a lot now, because I think it's so important, and obviously most of the guests that have come on here are an example of this. When we talk about mental health in our profession, I feel like we've just got stuck on the stigma. Oh, we've got to smash the stigma. Well, that doesn't mean anything. Of course, you know, don't shame someone who's struggling, but there's so much more of this conversation than that. I think where there's real, you know, hope, there's almost excitement, is the post-traumatic growth, going through this unique toolbox that each one of us puts together, whether it's, you know, Boulder Crest Struggle Well and EMDR and psychedelics and, you know, canine therapy or whatever that unique cocktail is for you. The incredible growth that I see these men and women have. And just like you said, this happened to me, and this happened to me, and this call shook me. I did this work, and now I found value in each of these. And I think, you know, like the Japanese analogy, they fix the pottery with the gold glue. I think that's it. I think there's a lot of hope in simply doing the work and realizing the other side is worth it. Like, you will be a better version of yourself. A better firefighter, a better father, a better, you know, husband or wife. So talk to me about that part. You know, when you reflect back to when you were struggling, you know, who are you today? And let's kind of, you know, unpack post-traumatic growth a little bit more.
Yeah, the Kintsugi Bowl, that's a really cool analogy. I love that one. I think the biggest one that was taught in both programs was just the trust and connection. Because in both programs, you do share. And like you said, you feel like you're going to get judged, and you feel like you're going to get shunned, and people are going to turn their back on you. And if they really care about you, that's not going to happen. And hell, even in those two experiences, I had just met these people. And when everybody shared, all that was said was, thank you for sharing. There was no advice given. There was no blame given. I mean, even right now, I could have told you all this stuff. And historically, right? Like, oh, you went through all that. You could have just responded with, well, just suck it up, man. You're good now. Like, you got a good family. You got a good job. Like, what's the problem? Like, it's more than that. That's just the facade I put on. That's my Instagram reel that I want you to see all the highlights, but there's a lot more going on, because again, that could turn into an addiction of like, well, I need to be successful to hide all this other stuff. So really just the vulnerability. And I remember doing it with one of my crews one time. I was like, I don't know how this is going to work, but I'm just going to be super vulnerable around the dinner table and tell them how I feel about these certain calls and see what happens. And holy cow, did that just open up the conversation, and we became a super tight crew. And that was incredible. I was like, oh, it actually works. Like, people want to hear everyone's stories. And it's just the problem of like, I gotta be strong. I gotta be trusted. I'm not gonna be trusted if I'm weak. And that's not true at all. So that's the biggest thing I learned, is like, I still go out and run a fire and I can still have it affect me a certain way and just be open about it. I can still run a bad medical call and let's dope it out and talk about it. Let's not just bury it. And I feel so much more present with my family. I feel present with myself. I've forgiven myself. I'm open to hear other people's stories and a lot less judging as well. Like, you don't know what people are going through, and just understanding that, you know, being on your phone or hitting people up on text, that's not the way to do it. You got to actually talk and connect and be with people and get past that surface level conversations. Just open yourself up, because that's how you're going to create deep conversations. If we just sat here and talked about, you know, sports scores and the weather all day, no one's going to listen to that. No one cares. We're not getting after what it means to be a human. Not, and forget about man and woman, this, that, and the other. It's about human connection. That's why fire isn't so important. You know, come together at the bonfire and share your feelings and whatnot. So from where I was to where I'm at, where I was the fun loving party drinker. Let's get after it. But then I was home alone. I was a mess. Now I'm good by myself and good with others. And that's a great feeling, of not feeling lonely when I am by myself, and just trying to stop that trauma line for my daughter as much as I can, and just be a better person for myself and others. Like, I can't help anybody else if I don't help myself.
Absolutely. It's funny, I've been reflecting on courage and cowardice a lot recently. I just posted an article, which I'm sure upset some people, but that's because they probably see themselves in it. But if you actually think about, and again, I'm 6 years removed now, but what I'm assuming is probably still continuing to get better, which is, you know, the safety as far as the fireside, and more infrequent that a lot of house fires are coming. If you think about a firefighter's 24 hours, how often do we actually have to be courageous operationally, running into a school shooting, you know, going through a second floor window in a VES search for a kid that you know is in there? It's hardly ever. We train for it, and rightly so, but it's hardly ever. Where there's courage, where we really need people to be that brave man or woman, is courageous vulnerability, having the courage to actually open up, talk about, you know, not just struggling, just talking about how fucking awful that call was, you know, and not even so much the victim, but the shrieks of the family when we pulled that yellow sheet over them, you know what I mean? Those kind of things. And also the courage of advocating for an environment that supports you. Because if we're just identifying as the sooty faced mustachioed firefighter leaning on a pike pole, that's a once in a blue moon that you truly, truly get to do that. But every single day you get to be courageous advocating for your family's health, and you get to be courageous by opening the doors for others to talk by you being vulnerable.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I'm really proud of. My fire district is, they have adopted the struggle well, and it's really cool. Every class is opened up with our fire chief telling his story in front of everybody. So it's twofold, right? Hey, you can be in a position of power and still be vulnerable. You don't have to keep a mask on to make rank and be quote unquote successful. But also it also opens the doors. Like, look, the fire chief just spilled his guts. Everyone else can too. This is a place of trust. And yeah, I think it's easier too. You see it in the struggle well courses, and I've heard it from other guides. It's a little easier for the firefighters to talk. They want to talk. They want to open up about these things. I worry about sometimes our police brothers and sisters, because they're mostly alone. They're in their squad cars by themselves. At least we're either on an ambo with another person or in the engine talking it out. And I think it's imperative for the captains or whoever's leading on the box or whoever the leader, informal leader or leader in the fire station, for them to set the tone. You know, you start shutting down these conversations and don't let them happen, it's not going to go well at all. And then for the younger guys and gals coming up, that's how they're going to learn, just like we did. Like, oh, you don't talk about that stuff. No, I don't bring it up. But if right away you're talking about it, opening up, advocating for yourself, advocating for the crew, advocating for patients, whoever, inviting PD over for dinner because they just ran a crappy call with you, and building those relationships, that is so much stronger. It's just like a family unit. If you got a family that you just, one person's in each room watching TV and they're not talking, that's not going to be a strong family. There's no different from the fire service as well. Like, there's a part of me that wishes we could bring back open bay bunks so we're always together, but there's some niceness as well as having your own room. But it just has to be done. Like, we got to get back to being little mini tribes, and not tribes where we hate other people and we're trying to fight, but just these little tight knit groups that you can be trusted and have that connection, and no one's going to burn you. Like, yeah. I've never been burned for being authentic and vulnerable as far as like who I am as a person, my feelings. Yeah, if you mess up on the training ground or you do some bonehead thing, yeah, you're gonna get made fun of or second guess. But when you're no shit talking about how you feel, who you are, your values, and having these deep conversations, I just don't feel like that's a place anyone's gonna burn you. And it's just important to do.
Yeah. Where I see the people that do are actually the ones that are struggling. You know, the guy 100%. That's just kind of talking shit the whole time. But so again, it's like, you know, as I say on here a lot, and it's not my quote, but I love it. You know, don't ask what's wrong with you. Ask what happened to you, you know? And yeah. I think that's, you know, that crotchety old fucker is probably hurting. He's probably drinking himself to sleep every night. So it's, you know, maybe rather than lash out at them, kind of start figuring out, well, how can you access that person as well? But I mean, the firehouse is set up in many, many ways for us to be vulnerable, for us to have conversations. And if you look at our forefathers, what they did well, they had a dog in the station, you know? I don't know why we got rid of that, or this bullshit lawsuit mentality that we have in this country. But then also the dining room table. Like, I think individual bunks are great, but just have a policy where all, you know, there's times where you eat together, you sit together, you know, work out together, play volleyball, whatever it is. And then, yeah, absolutely, go in your bunk and, you know, call your kids. And obviously, when you sleep, you shouldn't get woken up by other rigs that are running. So that's what makes those bunks great. But yeah, if you're going to have this kind of layout in the station, create a culture where during the day you're all together, because that's what you should be doing. And that gives you then the opportunity to actually start sharing stories and offload some of the stuff that you just went through.
Yeah, absolutely. I just went to a teach back for the struggle course, and it was pretty cool. One of the captains was talking about how they're going to, because they, I mean, there's so many different practices they teach you in these courses. I mean, we could spend hours talking about it, but one of the things he was going to adopt is, hey, when we come back from our 4 days off, one of the first things I'm asked the crews is like, how was your week? How's your wellness triangle? Because they talk about your wellness triangle, your mind, body, financial, and spirit. How's your triangle doing? Is there anything that happened on your days off that you want to talk about? Is there anything that happened that may affect your performance or just how you want to be interacted with? Are you on edge? Like, and just going through the table and letting them do that. Because if a lot of people went through the course and they're speaking the same language, and that's really cool. And putting gratitude boards up in the house. And I know some of the police stations have put gratitude boards up, and just simple things to put up there. And it's a really cool barometer as well, right? Like, if I got a guy that or gal that's every day they put gratitude up there or some cool quote, and 3 days in a row they don't put anything and they're moping around, I know something happened and we're going to have a conversation. And it's not a, I'm going to come down on you, what's going on, I need you to perform conversation. It's going to be like, hey, I've noticed this. How you doing? What happened? What's going on? So just meeting everybody with wonder instead of questioning. Like, I wonder what's going on with them. I wonder what happened.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned about your department adopting Struggle Well. What does that look like?
So I don't have all the ins and outs, but they're hosting the Struggle Well. And I think the ultimate goal is to get everybody through, but they don't want to push it. And I can't speak too much on them. I haven't been there, but what I've seen and heard is the goal is to get everybody through, especially those that want to get through. And the really cool thing is they've opened it up. So they'll fit it with mostly people from the fire district, but they've opened up to local PD, other fire, and other people that want to get in there too. So it's just not a, hey, if you're not a part of us, you can't get this. They see the value in it, and they want to expose as many people as they can to it as well. Because I was able to sneak some of the military members into a few classes, and that was very beneficial.
Absolutely. Now, did you mention that you transitioned back into the military for a while?
Yes. So I got out of active duty in 08, took a little break, and then bounced around between the Guard and Reserve. So right after my father passed, and this was some reflection I did and realized why I was so hesitant to go back to fire, why I isolated from the fire service. I was like, oh, I'm going to do this military thing, and this is what I need to be doing. So I was on orders for 5 years, and that's coming to an end in May. So I'll retire from the Air National Guard and then go back to the firehouse in May and do some training, however long that's going to take, and get back on the rig.
Brilliant.
So a lot of back and forth.
Beautiful. Well, I want to throw some closing questions at you before I let you go, if you've got time.
Yeah, of course.
All right. The first one I love to ask, is there a book or are there books that you love to recommend? It can be related to our discussion today or completely unrelated.
Yeah. So shameless plug for you. Definitely The Kinder Book. I mean, that was incredible. I really enjoyed that. And I liked our back and forth about that. I almost writ you off if it didn't end the way I wanted it to. But the Struggle Well book. There's actually a Struggle Well book, which is pretty incredible. Comfort Crisis is great. And then Dr. Egger, The Gift and the Choice. Those are really cool, talking about the difference between being a victim and living in victimhood, because we're all going to go through something. It's just, how do we end up on the other side? And like the fun books that I wrote down was like any Jack Carr. Manhunt's pretty cool. It's about the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Very detailed. That's a fun one. Neverending Story. I rewatched that movie and realized how traumatic that movie is when I was little. And that book was pretty cool.
Beautiful.
So for books, that's what I got. And then the Ryan Holiday, the Stoic ones are always good.
Well, you mentioned Neverending Story, the film. What about other films and documentaries that you love?
Growing Up Chicago, Last Dance was incredible. You know, the Chicago Bulls story, that was cool. And I just watched that Unstoppable movie with the wrestler from ASU with one leg. That was pretty cool. And I mean, most of our movies now are Moana or Clifford the Big Red Dog and Tumbleleaf with my daughter. So not a lot of adult movies going on right now.
Yeah, I just watched that documentary as well. I mean, sorry, the Unstoppable as well. And it was amazing. I'm going to see if I can get the actual guy on the show.
Oh, that'd be cool. That'd be really cool.
All right. Well, speaking of amazing people, is there a person that you recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military, and associated professions of the world?
Oh, man. I'd have to throw out probably Ken Falk, the founder of Oldercrest Foundation. Like, that'd be probably pretty cool. Some of the people that I've guided with and that I've been involved with Bouldercrest and Struggle Well, some of those guides would be pretty powerful, because there's some police, there's some military and fire. It's a good mix. If able, Dr. Tedeschi and Dr. Calhoun, the ones that coined PTG and started that academic research as well, that would be pretty cool to hear their story, because it's an incredible program. It did a lot for me.
Beautiful. All right. Well, then the last question before we make sure everyone knows where to find you and Bouldercrest, what do you do to decompress?
Oh, so I just started jiu-jitsu about 2 years ago. That's been incredible. I was scared to death to do it. I've wanted to do it for a long time. And so that's been really helpful. Hiking, rucking, working out. So most of the things I do to decompress, a lot of daddy-daughter time with the family. So that's very helpful. Meditation, all the stuff I learned through Warrior Path and Struggle Well, journaling.
Brilliant. All right. Well, then for people listening, if they want to reach out to you or find you online, where are the best places for that?
Probably nowhere, to be quite honest. I don't follow my social media anymore. I don't have any big platforms. If for some random reason someone wanted to talk to me, I guess they could reach out to you and get my email, but yeah, that's a tough one. I don't feel that I'm that special. I'm still super honored to be here. And I don't really have a big platform like, hey, come find me.
Yeah, well, it doesn't matter at all. I mean, that's good. It's funny because I was doing research before the show, and I'm like, oh, shit, I actually don't know much about Tony's life, because most people have a LinkedIn or something. But I mean, for us in the fire service, you know, what's the point? You're not really trying to sell anything. You know what I mean? You're not networking in business. So yeah. What about Bouldercrest, Struggle Well, Warrior's Path? Where are the best kind of places to find those?
Yeah, I think Google Bouldercrest. It's all under there. Google Struggle Well, Warrior Path, or Bouldercrest. All the information's on there. You know, to apply for Warrior Path. And then So another one, so the Warrior Path is mostly focused around veterans, but then they have the Struggle Well Experience, which is for first responders. So kind of the same thing with different cohort, because it's very tight-knit group. There's 8 of us in the course, and we're still, every day we talk on Signal, and it's the cool thing about the Warrior Path and Struggle Well Experience is it's not a catch and release. It's a 5 to 7 day in person, and then it's still another 90 days after that where you have bi-weekly meetings with your team and daily homework. So it's a very long process, which is very helpful. So just Google those, and then Struggle Well, you can Google that one as well. And that one's more the 5 day in person that's hosted by an agency. So if your local agency is doing it, get after it. If something you want to do, pitch it. There's plenty of POCs on there of like how to get it to your organization. You know, I know they go out and do, I think they call it executive days, 1 and 2 day exposure to the decision makers and show them what it's all about. And it goes from there, but definitely powerful.
Brilliant. Well, mate, I want to say thank you so much. I mean, not only for talking about, you know, Struggle Well and Bouldercrest and all these solutions, these tools that people can add again to their toolbox, and kudos to your department for actually bringing that in themselves, but also to underline your courageous vulnerability for going to these places and, you know, opening the door and talking about these traumas that you had early, and then this incredible strength that you've gleaned from them now working through. So I want to thank you so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Yeah, appreciate it, brother. Hopefully I didn't disappoint. This was a fantastic opportunity. I'm just glad to have this time with you and tell a story. Hopefully you can help somebody, you know, like we all got something going on. And, you know, I know from the outside, they look at me like successful in the military, wearing the red helmet, like, oh, that guy's got his shit together. And it couldn't be further from the truth. You know, it was a nice mask I wore for a long time, and I'm ready to peel it back and be open and help anybody that's willing to get that help. And at the end of the day, we're all going to experience something bad, and you can call it big T's, little T's, whatever name you want to put on it. It's just, how do we overcome it? And we're all strong enough to do that. I mean, that's why we're human. And we've all survived 100% of our trauma so far. So there's light at the end of the tunnel. Some tunnels are longer than others, but just keep pressing. You can get through it. It's a lot of work, but it's worth it to live the good life that we deserve.